Welcome to the deep dive. If you're looking for a fast, thorough understanding of complex professional standards, well, you are definitely in the right place.
Glad to be here.
Today, we're diving deep into the specialized world of manual medicine MM, specifically for physicians. Our guide is the framework from the FIMM Guidelines 2025.
Yes, the International Federation for Manual Musculoskeletal Medicine Guidelines. They really set the standard globally.
Our mission, yours and mine, is to give you quick, clear insight into the structure, the training, and the core knowledge needed for physicians in this field.
Exactly.
And maybe before we jump into the, you know, the training details, let's clarify what we're talking about. Manual medicine, it's often confused with general body work.
That's right? A really common misconception, yeah.
Yeah.
But it's quite distinct. It's a specific medical discipline focused squarely on the locomotor system, muscles, joints, bones, and somatic function.
Okay, so locomotor system, somatic function. Got it.
And maybe the most important thing to grasp right away is the physician's core approach, how they actually start. Diagnosis always, always begins with a really extensive, precise patient history.
Yeah.
And then,
yeah.
Then comes a functional investigation, mostly done using their hands.
Right, predominantly by hand. That really flips the usual script of, you know, jumping straight to an MRI or something.
It does. And it's not primarily about cost saving, though that can be a benefit. It's a diagnostic principle first. Function over structure, unless there's a strong suspicion of a serious structural issue.
So the scans, the x-rays, CTs, MRIs, they come later if needed.
Exactly. Only if the MM physician suspects an important structural lesion that really needs that kind of validation. The main goal of therapy is always restoring function, getting things moving better, and crucially, trying to avoid unnecessary medication wherever possible.
That avoidance of medication is a big point. And I imagine dealing with the locomotor system, a lot of this involves chronic pain or long-term issues.
Oh, absolutely. Chronic conditions are very common. And the guidelines are clear. This isn't magic. For complex chronic pain, you have to combine MM techniques with a broader approach.
Like what kind of approach?
An interdisciplinary, multimodal, biopsychosocial one. It acknowledges the whole person, the psychological factors, the social context. It's genuinely holistic care for these functional disorders and even painful structural problems where, you know, function can still be improved.
Okay, that sets the scene really well. Holistic, function first, hands-on diagnosis. Let's talk boundaries then. What is this specially trained physician actually expected to do and what skills do they all share? This gets really interesting.
Right, the scope is pretty robust according to FIMM. The trained physician needs the full skill set for diagnosis, including differential diagnosis, which is key.
So ruling things out.
Precisely. Then treatment, obviously, including prevention advice, patient education, and guidance on rehabilitation. And all of this has to be grounded in scientific principles and best practices.
So the physician holds the ultimate diagnostic responsibility, but can they delegate parts of the treatment?
Yes. Once the diagnosis is firmly established by the physician, they can involve other specially trained non-medical personnel.
Like physios.
Exactly. Physiotherapists, occupational therapists, people trained in applying certain manual techniques or helping with patient education. But, and this is critical, the initial diagnosis and the overall management plan, that stays with the MM physician.
Okay, oversight is key. Now let's nail down those core competencies. You said there are skills every physician offering MM must have. What are they?
There are four foundational ones. First, they absolutely have to be trained in functional testing. Analyzing normal and pathological movements of joints, muscles, the whole system.
Makes sense. Functional testing for a functional approach.
Second, highly developed manual palpation skills. And not just muscles. We're talking all tissues.
Yeah.
Skin, fascia, muscle, bone, even the joint capsule itself.
Wow. All tissues. That requires, I mean, incredibly sensitive hands and a lot of practice.
It really does. The third is being able to use manual pain provocation tests that are reliable and reproducible. Trying to objectify that pain response a bit.
Okay. Reliability and reproducibility, bringing science to the touch.
Yes. And fourth, naturally, is being experienced in actually providing various manual techniques safely and effectively. Those four are the bedrock.
Got it. Functional testing, palpation of all tissues, reliable pain tests, and technique proficiency. And this all needs official recognition, right? It can't just be an informal thing.
No, absolutely not. The guidelines emphasize the administrative side, too.
Mm-hmm.
Who's eligible for training? Where did the training happen? And crucially, how is it officially recognized?
Through assessment, I assume.
Yes, and preferably a pretty thorough one,
yeah.
Ideally involving both written exams and practical, hands-on clinical tests.
Okay, that assessment piece brings us nicely to a big topic in medical education today. Before we map out the four levels of training, we need to understand how FIM actually views the assessment of competence. They talk about two different educational models, don't they?
They do, and it reflects a wider shift, really. It's the comparison between the, let's say, traditional structure and process-based way and the more modern competency-based model.
Right. Let's break that down. What does the traditional structure-based model look like?
Okay, so the traditional one is mainly driven by content, acquiring knowledge. The big focus is on time spent. You know, you have to log X number of hours, say 300 hours, get Y number of credits, maybe 30 credits.
Clocking the hours?
Pretty much. And the assessment tends to be summative, often a single exam or evaluation at the very end, which can sometimes be a bit subjective.
Okay. So how does the competency-based approach differ? It sounds like it focuses elsewhere.
It absolutely does. It's driven by outcome. Can the learner actually apply the knowledge and skills in a real-world setting? The focus shifts squarely onto the learner and demonstrating those professional competences.
And the time factor.
Time becomes variable. If you can prove you've mastered the necessary skills sooner, you potentially move on faster. It's not just about seat time.
That sounds much more focused on actual ability, and the assessment must be different too.
Hugely different. Assessment is more formative, ongoing feedback, and uses multiple objective measures. Things like an evaluation portfolio, maybe logbooks of procedures you've been signed off on.
Like building a case that you can do the job.
Exactly. And the key word is authentic. The assessments are designed to mimic real professional tasks. So it's not just about passing a multiple choice test. It's about showing you can handle clinical situations effectively.
So one model checks the clock, the other checks the capability. How does FIM view these two? Is one better?
Interestingly, FIM views them as equivalent. They acknowledge both paths can lead to competent physicians. National bodies or training programs can choose the model that best fits their system and needs.
That's quite flexible. Acknowledging the end goal, competence, is what matters most.
Precisely. It's about ensuring the physician has the demonstrable skills, whether you got there via fixed hours or verified outcomes.
Okay, understanding those assessment philosophies is crucial. Now, let's trace the actual career progression. There are four distinct training levels outlined. Let's start at the beginning. Level one, where does that fit in?
Level one happens during medical school, or what's called the predoctoral level. The main goal here is really just foundational understanding.
Like basic exposure.
Yeah, getting a fundamental grasp of musculoskeletal issues. Often it's integrated into existing courses like basic anatomy or physiology.
But is it enough? I think the source mentioned something about graduates often being undertrained in this area.
That's right. A U.S. survey highlighted that many medical school grads feel unprepared to handle common musculoskeletal complaints, which is a huge part of practice. So level one aims to start bridging that gap.
What basic skills would someone get at this level?
Things like inspection, just looking properly, basic palpation, testing range of motion. Also understanding principles of self-mobilization, strengthening, and stabilizing exercises they might advise patients on.
But no specific diploma comes with this.
Typically, no. It's part of the general medical education.
Okay, so level one is foundational. Level two, then. That's called the MM recognition or facility level. What's the objective there?
Right. Level two is about achieving real competence for the primary care setting. Being able to prevent, manage, and provide functional treatment for the common musculoskeletal issues that walk through the door every day.
Which is probably a lot of a primary care physician's caseload.
A very significant portion, yes.
So what's the time commitment for level two? How much training are we talking about?
It's around 100 hours of organized tuition plus self-learning, and also requires about 12 months of relevant clinical experience applying what you're learning.
And the key competency gain.
The main thing is gaining a solid skill set of safe and effective manual techniques suitable for that primary care level. And interestingly, the guidelines point out that students in U.S. Colleges of Osteopathic Medicine, CONSAS, actually receive supervised training up to this level by the end of their second year.
Ah, so it's already integrated into some established systems. That's good context. Okay, moving up, level three, the MM specialist level. This sounds like a bigger leap.
It absolutely is. Level 3 is about achieving the competence needed for independent practice as an MM specialist.
Meaning?
Meaning they can make a specific MM diagnosis on their own and then design and implement a full management and treatment plan, which includes comprehensive functional rehabilitation.
That sounds significantly more demanding. What's the training involved?
It is more demanding. We're looking at approximately 300 hours of organized tuition and supervised practice, plus around 24 months, 2 years of relevant clinical experience.
And the competency focus?
It requires profound clinical expertise. They need to master a complete set of manual techniques relevant to their specific medical or surgical specialty, because MM physicians can come from various backgrounds.
How is this level assessed? More than just exams?
Yes, assessment is more involved. Often includes building that portfolio of experience we talked about, and frequently requires a written dissertation or a research project showing deeper academic engagement.
Okay, specialist level, deep expertise, research component. That leaves level 4, the master level or doctorate level, the peak.
That's the pinnacle, yes. This level equips physicians for roles typically associated with a hospital-based MM department, handling complex tertiary referrals, providing expert consultations, leading research, and teaching the next generation.
So, the academic leaders and top clinicians, what's the pathway after hitting level 3?
It requires a minimum of another 24 months of experience after completing level 3. This usually involves working within a university department or equivalent high-level setting. And it typically culminates in a master's or doctoral thesis or a comparable major academic work.
And the knowledge required must be exceptionally broad and deep.
Absolutely. It demands extensive academic knowledge, the ability to critically interpret complex musculoskeletal function, and mastery of a complete set of manual techniques applicable to a very wide range of conditions, including the really challenging cases.
That progression makes sense. Foundational, primary care, specialist, and finally, the master academic level. It really highlights that ability to think as a comprehensive diagnostician. Let's dig into some specifics from the core topics syllabus, Chapter 8. What kind of knowledge depth are we talking about, even at earlier levels?
It's quite revealing. Take pain, for example. Even at level 1, they need to grasp basic pain physiology.
All right.
But jump to level 3.
Yes.
By level 3, they need to be able to describe the complex relationship between psychosocial factors and chronic pain. That's huge. And also understand the role of the autonomic nervous system in pain states.
Wow. Okay. That's way beyond just knowing where the nerve is. It's about the brain, stress, the whole system's response.
Exactly. And by level 4, they need to understand essentially all the current proposed mechanisms and models of pain. A deep dive into pain science.
That's fascinating. What about biomechanics? You mentioned the hands-on aspect. Does the science get specific there too?
They're very specific. Look at the terminology. By level 2, physicians need to be comfortable applying quite technical biomechanical terms to tissues.
Like what?
Terms like stress, strain, stiffness, toughness, viscoelasticity, creep, hysteresis, and even fatigue failure.
Hold on, creep, hysteresis. Those sound like they belong in an engineering lab. Why does an MM physician need those?
They are engineering concepts, essentially, applied to biological tissues. Think about it. Creep describes how a tissue, like fascia, slowly deforms or stretches under a constant sustained pressure, exactly what happens during some manual techniques.
Ah, good.
And hysteresis is about the energy lost or the lag in the tissue returning to its original state after the pressure is removed. Understanding these helps the physician gauge how much force to use, for how long, and how the tissue is responding. It brings a level of precision to the hands-on work.
That connects the field directly to physics.
Brilliant. What about the actual examination process? Is there a specific method they follow? Yes. The guidelines detail a systematic approach. It usually starts with a screening examination.
A quick check.
Right. A rapid assessment to determine if the patient's problem likely originates from the locomotor system at all. If it does, then they proceed to a more focused scanning examination.
To narrow it down.
Exactly. To pinpoint the specific dysfunctional regions or tissues that are relevant to the patient's complaint and the working diagnosis.
And during that detailed palpation, what specifically are they feeling for?
Several things. Obviously, pain provocation. Does touching here reproduce their pain? Also, any sensory changes like numbness or tingling. Changes in tissue texture, tightness, swelling, ropiness. And a really key skill is examining the characteristics of the end-feel barrier.
End-feel barrier. Can you explain that a little for us? What does that mean?
Sure. End-feel is that distinct sensation the examiner feels in their hands when they gently move a joint to the very end of its available passive range of motion.
What does it tell them?
It tells them what is stopping the movement. Is it a normal, elastic feel of muscle or capsule? Is it a hard, bony block? Is it a sudden muscle spasm stopping it early?
Okay.
That tactile feedback is crucial for diagnosis and for knowing if a mobilization technique is safe or appropriate.
That makes perfect sense. Tactile information guiding treatment. Finally, just to show the sheer academic depth at the top end, what are some of those really advanced, maybe even slightly theoretical concepts required only at level four?
This is where it gets into cutting-edge science and potential mechanisms. Level four physicians need to be able to discuss things like the possible role of interfacial water in connective tissue mechanics.
Interfacial water, seriously.
Seriously. And also concepts like the role of nitric oxide signaling in response to manual techniques. It's about understanding, or at least discussing, the potential physiological mechanisms happening at a cellular or even molecular level when they apply a technique.
Wow. Connecting the hands-on work right down to cell signaling and fluid dynamics, that's quite a journey from basic anatomy.
It really is. It
Yeah.
shows how the field strives to build that scientific bridge between the manual intervention and the underlying physiology.
It absolutely does. So, bringing this all together, this deep dive really shows that manual medicine training under FEM is, well, it's incredibly structured. It's a clear stepwise progression. It masterfully blends that defining feature, the hands-on functional diagnosis, with some really rigorous academic science. And it's governed by standards that recognize both time spent and, importantly, demonstrated competency.
Well said. And it's worth remembering that the guidelines constantly emphasize continuing professional development. The responsibility doesn't end when you get the diploma.
Yeah.
Qualified physicians and surgeons have to keep updating their knowledge across all relevant medical areas throughout their careers.
Constant learning, like all good medicine.
Okay, so we've learned that diagnosis hinges so much on that physical hands-on examination. Given this huge emphasis on palpation and clinical skill, here's something for you, the listener, to think about.
Ah, the provocative thought.
Level four training, the highest level, specifically requires these physicians to be able to document the reproducibility and the inter-examiner reliability of their diagnostic tests. Think about that. What impact do you think that specific requirement, proving consistency between different examiners, has on advancing the overall scientific acceptance and validation of manual medicine as a field? Something to ponder until our next deep dive.